From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. Today, it's easy to think of nature as a playground. The wild world around us as contained by GPS, state-of-the-art equipment, and guidebooks. This hour, we take a walk on nature's wild side and hear stories about the hidden power in the natural world around us.
The tiger is brilliantly designed to do what they do, and one of those things is to meet and dispense with threats and competitors. There are brown bears that live there, the equivalent to an American grizzly, and tigers will kill them.
When a chimpanzee attacks a human, for example, part of what it's doing is trying to remove your jaws. So it treats you as an equal. It sees that it needs to remove your weapons.
The water just between me and those sea lions starts roiling and bubbling, and then without any other warning, humpback whale.
According to journalist John Valiant, tigers are nature's final word in weapon design. They possess immense strength, massive claws, and bone-crushing jaw power that's closer to dinosaurs than other mammals today. So, imagine the community dread when one of Siberia's rare Amur tigers goes rogue and begins hunting humans with skill, intelligence, and patience. That's the story found in Valiant's book, The Tiger. But the book isn't about terror in the animal world alone. It's a story about the intersection between socioeconomics and conservation in a remote corner of Siberia. Valiant told Steve Paulson that his story begins with a grisly killing. A tiger stalks and attacks a poacher named Markov, and Yuri Trush, an anti-poaching tracker, is charged with finding the tiger.
Markov had been driven to poaching, like so many of his neighbors, because there was literally no other way to feed one's family after perestroika and the collapse of the nationalized logging industry. And Yuri Trush, same age, also a paratrooper, in fact, like Markov, had been hired to lead an anti-poaching squad because with the collapse of Russia, there was an explosion of poaching, both of deer and fur-bearing animals, but also of big game like tigers, because the Chinese border was only about 60 miles from Sobolinya, and there's an active market for illegal tiger parts across the border.
And the Siberian tiger is really the stuff of legend, isn't it? I mean, for one thing, it's just a huge animal. I mean, they can be upwards of 500 pounds, 10 feet long.
It's generally considered to be the largest of the living cats. When you look at one and see the thick, almost lynx-like fur and the kind of burly massiveness that they manifest, you can see why this Russian biologist Nikolai Baikov firmly believed and wrote a long paper to this effect, making the case for the fact that the Amur tiger was a throwback to the Pleistocene. In other words, was a survivor from the days of the woolly mammoth, the cave bear, and the saber-toothed tiger. And people, you know, considered this seriously through the 1940s.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to get to the story of this man-eating tiger, but I think we need to set the context first. For one thing, why poaching is so problematic, and also why some people in the hinterlands are driven to do it. I mean, for one thing, the economic circumstances are just pretty devastating, aren't they?
They're dire, yeah. The Russian Far East and this particular territory there, Primorsky Krai, it's in the southeastern corner of Russia. It's 6,000 miles from the capital. It's closer to Australia than it is to the Kremlin. And it's surrounded by China on one side, the Sea of Japan on the other. To the south is North Korea. It's a very remote area, and it's all about resource extraction. So there's fur trapping, logging, mining, commercial fishing. In the early 90s, when perestroika basically undid the entire Soviet system, all these workers were suddenly, there was no market, there was no structure, there was no safety net. They were effectively abandoned. And they did whatever they had to survive. And a really unfortunate coincidence was the fact that the Chinese border, which had been closed for a long time and it actually helped protect the Russian tigers on the Russian side, opened. And suddenly you have destitute Russians with an available population of tigers able now to trade with Chinese who have never been wealthier and have an apparently bottomless appetite for tiger parts used for medicinal purposes and status symbols.
So here is this incredible market for tigers in a way. I mean, obviously it's illegal to kill these animals in Russia, but your hero, Yuri Trush, is out there trying to find the poachers who are gunning for the tigers, and if necessary, to take their guns away. It sounds like a hard job.
In the winter of 1992 and 1993, in that 14-month period, more than 100 tigers were killed and exported to South Asia. That's about a quarter of the wild population remaining in Russia. And they realized then that if they didn't put something in place quickly, there'd be no more tigers. And so Inspection Tiger was created, a very well-armed and well-trained anti-poaching agency. And the money is big. And because there was chaos in the forest and also in the city, you could find all kinds of things in the forest because the armories were being looted. So people were using these kinds of civilian tanks to go poaching in. You could come into a cabin, a remote cabin, and find cases of TNT, stolen 50 caliber machine guns, all kinds of things. And so the type of random potential for violence that Trush and his men were dealing with, really can't be underestimated.
Huh. So Yuri Trush is called in to deal with this man-eating tiger. He's just found Markov, in fact, the man we were talking about earlier, who wasn't just mauled. I mean, he was eaten by the tiger. What did Yuri Trush make of this? What did he see?
Well, he'd been told there'd been a tiger attack, and this happens, and he knew he was going into an area where there's a lot of poaching. There are, accounts of people who have shot tigers and been hunted down by them, but he didn't know what to expect. And it's only when he began to investigate the site and began to realize the strange kind of concentrated attention that the tiger had been devoting to certain objects around Markov's property. And these were objects that would have had his scent on them, like his axe handle, like the water dipper that he used to gather water from the well. When the tiger found these items, he destroyed them, tore them apart, killed his dogs, and then circled and circled and circled the house and basically laid claim to the property, almost like he kind of put a sort of lien on it, if you will, and then waited for Markov to return. And so Trush concluded, especially after seeing the blood in the tiger tracks, that something must have happened between Markov and this tiger. And the tiger was able to identify Markov and track him.
Now, you said that for a tiger to do this, to lay claim to Markov's cabin, to wait for Markov to hunt him down, there had to be past history between the two of them. Did Trush figure out what had happened?
He did. It was determined that Markov had shot the tiger. They had come into conflict of some kind. It was just them and the dogs when it happened. And Markov shot the tiger at point-blank range with his shotgun. And this, was determined forensically, actually. But we see through the course of the story how Trush's understanding evolves as he slowly pieces together the weird and tumultuous brief history that Markov and this tiger had together.
I mean, you're really describing the tiger as if he were another person. it got personal between the tiger and the human being.
It absolutely did. And, this is the thing, the tiger is a higher mammal, not as high as we might like to think ourselves as being, but, definitely smarter than a deer, closer to a dog. In their sphere, they're brilliantly designed to do what they do. And one of those things is to meet and dispense with threats and competitors, to control territory, and to be the master of all it surveys. They are the dominant creature. There are brown bears that live there, the equivalent to an American grizzly, and tigers will kill them.
Wow.
Yeah, exactly. The tiger is the supreme being in that forest.
Mm-hmm. So when Trush was piecing together the murder scene, the tiger who killed Markov, did he figure out what happened?
Well, he made a few assumptions. Again, there's a saying, in the taiga, in the Russian forest, there are no witnesses. And what happened between Markov and the tiger can't be known for certain. But Trush, who was, quite experienced in the dynamics between humans and dogs and tigers, believed that it was some kind of altercation over a kill, over a dead boar in this case. And it was either a boar that the tiger had killed and that Markov had come upon with his dogs and tried to take some of, or it was a boar that Markov had killed and the tiger had come upon it and was trying to take some. In any case, the dogs got involved. Very possibly the tiger killed one of the dogs, and then Markov felt moved to shoot the tiger. And that's, you know, often a cause for conflict between humans and tigers is the dogs, because tigers kill wolves and they also kill and eat dogs.
Hmm. So later, the tiger laid siege to Markov's cabin and eventually killed Markov. And then Trush and his men, it sounds like, got on the scene quite fast, to the point where, didn't they think the tiger was right near them as they were examining the murder scene?
Oh, there was no doubt that the tiger was right near them. The tiger heard the men coming. You know, they drove up in a big truck. They all pile out. They've all got their weapons. Markov's friends are there. Trush and his three squad mates are there. They find the tracks. It's all easy to see in the snow. They follow it in, follow, you know, the bits and pieces that have been left behind, come to the sites where Markov has been eaten. And then Trush's dog alerts them to the fact that the tiger is nearby. The dog is going crazy. And they can see by the state of the tracks. I mean, there's so much data in the tracks. You can tell the time. You can tell the health of an animal. You can tell so many things about it by looking at the tracks. And one thing that's clear is how fresh the tracks are. It's like they've been made just moments earlier. So the tiger moved off from the site in response to these men's approach. And it was thick brush. And so the tiger, in Trush's estimation, was roughly 40 yards away, waiting.
Did he go after the tiger?
Well, he had to make a decision. To shoot a tiger legally in Russia, there are protected species there. You have to get permission from Moscow. And it's Saturday, and Moscow is literally a quarter of the way around the world away. So he's not going to be getting permission anytime soon. So it's dusk. The sun is now dropping over the horizon. It's very, very cold. Everybody is very, very upset by what they've seen. Markov's friends are having to gather up what's left of Markov. And he has to make a decision in that moment to continue tracking it and possibly get attacked himself, or to withdraw. And he decides to withdraw, and he examines the site. And part of his rationale is that there's a law of the jungle, and that is, if you wound a tiger and the tiger identifies you, the tiger may very well come after you. And here the feeling was, well, the score has been settled. Maybe, hopefully, the tiger will go back into the forest and return to life, the life it had been living prior to this conflict.
So Trush maybe was figuring, well, that's the last he was going to see of this tiger, but then it turned out the tiger killed another person.
That's right. A week went by. Trush, you know, did all the right things. You know, he wrote up his report. He went on television. He went on the radio. He reported in the newspaper, this is what's happened. We believe it was a revenge killing. You know, that's the language they use there, a revenge killing by the tiger. But be very careful in the Bikin Valley right now. There's clearly a dangerous tiger there. And then he went back to work. He patrols a huge area. He has a lot of territory and illegal hunters that he needs to be keeping track of. And so he went back to work. And then he gets a call a week later, and the very scant remains of another poacher, another armed man who knew there was a dangerous tiger there, were discovered. Then there was no ambiguity about what the proper response was. Trush now had to devote all his attention and energy to hunting this tiger down.
Steve Paulson spoke with John Valiant about The Tiger, which ends with one final and fateful encounter between Yuri Trush and the rogue Siberian tiger. Coming up, the science of giant waves. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Scientists used to scoff at reports of 100-foot waves, because without data, waves like that violated the very rules of physics. But today, The science of mammoth waves is a hot field of study, relevant to everyone living on our very watery planet. In her new book, The Wave, Susan Casey meets legendary big wave surfer Laird Hamilton and writes about the ship Discovery, which played a key role in our understanding of giant waves.
They set out in February 2000 to the North Atlantic on a fairly typical research cruise. It would take them about 3 weeks, and they would sail up the coast of the UK to Scotland and then across to Iceland and take water samples for salinity, for temperature, various water readings, because one of the things that scientists are most concerned about with climate change is what is that going to do to the ocean circulation that delivers the heat, you know, to Western Europe that makes basically the climate moderate there. They're trying to figure that out. You know, we haven't been observing the weather or the oceans in any kind of concerted way for, I don't know, more than 30 years because satellites came along in 1980. So this was really important work, but it was very different than what they ended up doing. And what happened was they got into a series of storms, six back-to-back-to-back storms, and they were prevented from doing their work, and they were had their bow of the ship pointed into the waves because that's the only safe position. The ship doesn't want to get broadside to the waves, or it certainly doesn't want to have the waves behind it and get swamped. So they were just there, stuck in these waves, these 30, 40-foot waves. And then it looked like maybe things were getting better, and the weather forecasts and wave forecasts that they were looking at said, hey, yeah, you know, things might be getting better. And then that night, they were hit with an onslaught of waves that were fantastically huge, 60, 70, 80, 90, even approaching 100 feet tall. For almost 2 days, they were walloped by these unpredicted giant waves, and all the furniture was flying around, and the windows broke, the ship was twisting, people were really freaking out, and it was a very tenuous situation. They managed to get back to Southampton, and they managed to get all the data off the ship because it had a wave recorder. It had all these instruments around it, so they knew exactly what had happened to the ship. They could then compare it to the models, the weather models, the predictions that they had gotten that said that there is no way that 100-foot waves should be around. So that paper came out in 2006, and it was a really big deal because what all these models are used for all shipping, all recreational boating, and that goes a long way towards explaining why so many ships are lost, and it's a really huge number.
I think these are hard to understand. I mean, I was standing on the shore in Cape Cod just a little while ago, and I was saying, oh, what nice big waves are pounding on the shore. They were probably 6 feet high, and I thought they were big waves. You're talking about something that's almost unimaginable by comparison.
I don't think there's anything scarier. And at one point in the book, I saw a 70-foot wave from very close range. And when they get above 50 feet or 55 feet, they start doing something very different. And that is they really become vertical. They're like an advancing wall of water. I think the special effects people on the movie The Perfect Storm did a very good job of indicating that weird verticality that happens when a wave gets really, really big. And this feathering that happens at the top, which is quite harrowing to look at because you see it winding up. It's like somebody pulling their arm back to punch you, but it's really slow, but you know they're going to do it, and it's bigger and bigger. And there's nothing you can do to get away from it. These are super powerful. We saw how powerful in 2004 when the tsunami hit in Indonesia. And it was like, what do you mean a wave killed 250,000 people? I mean, it's just, even a wave your own height can kill you.
You talk about these waves very vividly. Have you seen them personally? Have you seen one of these monster waves close up?
I moved to Hawaii to spend time with this group of surfers that were all trying to chase these giant waves down, and I traveled with them all over the world in pursuit of them, and I went into the waves with them on jet skis.
You met a man named Laird Hamilton, and I guess the way you describe meeting him gives some perspective on these waves as well. You said he looks like a very, very big man when you're talking to him. Until you see him in a wave.
Well, he is. He's 6'3", and he has, when he's on an 80-foot wave, obviously, he's in a position that he refers to as Ant-Man.
This has to have been new to you. You were excited by it. You were looking for the waves. You were thrilled by the notion that he was riding them. Was it hard for you to decide that you were going to go out and feel what those waves felt like?
No, because that's what my goal was in writing the book. My goal was to take readers to the top of a 100-foot wave, or as close as I could get, and explain to them what it was like. Because if you think about it, you know, 1,900 people have been to the top of Everest, but who has been to the top of a 100-foot wave and come back to talk about it? Not very many. So from the get-go, that was the arrangement, that I would go out with him. And I moved to Maui, where this wave called Jaws exists off the north shore of Maui. And every time there was a very big day at Jaws, I would go out. I would either go out with Laird or another surfer or the cameraman, or I would go in the helicopter, that their safety helicopter that flies above the wave. But the thing is, those days are pretty rare. They might come along one, two, three times a season. So I started doing that in 2005. And then I went to a number of other waves with other surfers, including Mavericks off the coast of California near Half Moon Bay, and Todos Santos, which is a wave called Killers, down off the coast of Ensenada, and most notably, I think, outside of Hawaii, to a wave called Te Ahupo in Tahiti, which is considered to be the most dangerous wave in the world for big wave riders and has taken a number of lives. And that was a wave that Laird was very famous for riding under conditions that nobody thought could be ridden. And he took me into that wave as well on a jet ski in a situation where, you know, I was very aware that if something had gone wrong with the machine or if something had gone wrong with the conditions, if the wave had done something weird or if I had fallen off, that I probably wouldn't have survived it.
So tell me about a day, any day. Pick a day when you went out with Laird. You got on the jet ski. You knew that the big wave was coming. By this time, I guess you could predict when it was likely to be there. You couldn't know for sure. What do you do?
When they go to surf the big waves, and the waves that they surf, the big ones, are different than the rogue waves that are taking out ships. These waves come as a result of big storms. Usually when they hit Hawaii, it's the result of a big storm that brewed in the Gulf of Alaska and kind of came down at a certain angle and a certain velocity and hit a bottom feature, either a big reef or, in one case, a submerged mountain range. It needs to be quite deep water, and the feature needs to be quite big to create a giant wave. So on a day like that, they kind of know it's coming a few days out. Not always, but that gives them enough time to get on a plane if they need to. So a lot of, if let's say there was a big day at Jaws in Maui, a lot of surfers would have come from California. Some might have even come from South Africa. Some might have come from the South Pacific. Some might have come from Australia. They would have all converged there if the storm had been big enough, had produced what I refer to as a magenta blob on the weather radar maps, and they would be there, and you would see them pouring into the airport with all their camera equipment and surfing equipment, and you would see all the jet skis being worked on the night before, and you would sense a kind of frenetic energy in the air and a certain kind of nervousness. And then the next morning, they're out before dawn, and you just, when there's a swell that's going to create a 70 or 80 foot wave, there's just a huge amount of water moving around. It's like you're in the same ocean, but it's a completely different ocean. So you go into the marina and the water could be coming over the top of the pier, you know, like it's just, the water is really powerful because this energy has come in. And so then somehow we make it out to the wave. There's different ways. So you might have a boat that would sit in a channel close to the wave, or there might be just kind of a number of jet skis that would hold photographers. The surfers operate in teams. There's a driver and a rider, and the rider has a water ski tow rope, and the driver pulls him onto the wave, and then the surfer lets go. Because if a wave is over 40 feet tall, it can't be paddled into. It's just moving too fast. You know, it's like trying to merge into the highway on your bicycle or something. So on a day like that, you know, and the sun would come up and you see these waves, you know, they're really humbling. There's just nothing you can think about how powerful you are in the face of a 60 or 70 foot wave. And generally, the day will go on and people will ride. There's never more than one rider on a wave, 60 or 70 or 80 foot wave, because it's too dangerous.
Where do these waves come from? You talked about coming from all over the world. Do they live anywhere? Is there a sort of common source to them?
The energy, the wind that is created by the weather would be, I think, the most common source of giant storm waves. That's really, the energy is pumped into the water from the wind. So the more volatile a storm, the more energy that's in a storm, the more energy can transfer into the water, and thus, you know, the bigger the waves can get. You know, giant storm waves can happen anywhere, but there are places in the world where the wind blows over long stretches of ocean or, you know, with uninterrupted by land masses, and those places tend to create the biggest waves, like the belt of water around Antarctica is one of them. And the North Sea, the area that the Discovery was in from Scotland to Iceland, that's another long, they call it a fetch, a distance that the wind can, you know, blow unimpeded and create waves. And anywhere there's a long fetch, you can get giant waves.
So people are clearly beginning to believe in them now. I mean, some people always did. The data that was recovered from the survival of Discovery, did that start a new wave, if you will, of research into these giant monster waves?
There definitely is a lot of interest in waves right now, especially big waves. And I would say that what caused it, there were a couple things. The tsunami definitely impacted the sense that we didn't know enough or weren't aware of the geohistory of tsunamis enough. Like, we were really taken by surprise by that one, and possibly shouldn't have been, because it's a regular feature of the oceans. And if you they core into the seabed, and they can tell when the tsunamis happen by various layers of things that they find. So tsunami research got an influx of energy after that. And then the other thing that really impacted wave research was Katrina. The storm surge that inundated New Orleans made everybody clear that there's, you know, A, the power, and B, the vulnerability. And one of the chapters in the book, I go to a wave conference where the scientists are really fretting about what we don't know about giant storm surges and storm waves, and also asking themselves the question whether this is going to become more of a problem due to climate change. And the answer that the scientists gave me, all the ones that I spoke to, was yes, absolutely.
Susan Casey is the editor-in-chief of O Magazine and the author of The Wave. Journalist Gordon Grice has always been fascinated with the ferocious side of nature. In his book Deadly Kingdom, Grice takes us on a tour of the savage part of the wild world, a part, he says, is too often brushed under the rug, at our own peril. He told On Strange Champs about his own experience being stalked by a cougar.
I've spent a lot of time in the, you know, in rural areas and so forth, tracking animals, and although I don't hunt, but I'm interested just to observe them. And that particular incident, I wasn't looking for the animal, but I was helping herd some cattle, and a cougar was in the area. We knew from tracks, and we knew from an early experience that my friend had had. Suddenly, as we were loading these cattle, this was about twilight, we were putting them in a pen and shutting the gate, and then we really felt that we were being watched. And it was one of those things just like you hear about in the movies, you know, that sense that you're being watched. And the thing was that we didn't really know it was true or not, so we felt very scared and at the same time kind of silly.
You felt that you were being watched, but when you looked around, you couldn't see anything?
Yeah, there was some brush and so forth, so there was plenty of room for something to be looking at us that we couldn't see. And so we went back to the ranch house, and a few hours later, you know, going back in company and looking with the flashlight at the road, we could see that, in fact, a cougar had followed us and that its prints were lying over the top of ours.
When you felt like you were being watched and you couldn't see anything, did you just turn around and run straight back to the house, or what did you do?
We didn't. It was two grown men, and I think not wanting to look cowardly in front of each other was part of the reason. But we walked very slowly back, and we talked loudly because we knew enough to know that some animals are intimidated by that. And so we just walked slowly, if not calmly, back. We were looking around for weapons and, you know, picking up branches off the ground and so forth.
What did everybody say when you got back to the house?
Our friends didn't believe us until we went back later and found the tracks. Like me, they had, you know, their knowledge of wildlife was that it won't hurt you if you don't bother it. And, of course, that's the bone of contention that I take up in the book, that sometimes it does. Sometimes, even though, you know, at least I love wildlife and want to preserve it, that doesn't mean that it always wants to preserve us.
Well, that's what makes your book kind of chilling reading, because I don't know how, but I've sort of, over the years of doing a little hiking and reading about wildlife, I guess I've just sort of absorbed the general party line that, as you said, if you don't hurt the animals, they won't hurt you. You know, they're just going about their business. And the few times when people get hurt, it's the people's fault. They did something they weren't supposed to. This isn't true.
Yeah. It's not, well, I should say it's probably true, you know, 95% of the time. You know, most often, if there's a problem between humans and big predators, it's the human's fault. But that really isn't always the case. And we do know of cases where animals like grizzlies have stalked and attacked and even eaten people who had no idea that the animal was in the area.
The notion that an animal might prey on me because it it literally wants to eat me, not just attack me, is really kind of mind-bending. I guess as humans, we really are not used to thinking of ourselves as potential food. We can think of ourselves as enemies. Somebody might, or an animal might want to attack us because we're a threat, but not simply because they're hungry.
Yeah, it's a very strange thing in our culture, and it does vary across cultures. I mean, if you speak to people in Kenya, for example, it's not strange to them to think of animals simply wanting to eat them. But for us Americans especially, it's a very unusual idea. And I think it goes back to sort of the religious teachings that many people had grown up with, the idea that we were special, that we weren't here to serve other animals. They were here to serve us. A lot of us, you know, in the 60s and 70s discarded ideas like that. We realized that as humans, maybe we're not above other animals. But I think what took the place of that old-fashioned idea for many people was the idea that we're especially evil, that we, you know, whenever something bad happens, it's our fault. And I think that, too, is arrogant in a way. It's, you know, it's not the full story.
I imagine that everybody reading your book would have different animals that scare them most. But for me, the scariest stories in your book involved the hyenas, which just, they sort of go over the top.
Yeah, they're amazing predators. The spotted hyenas, which is the largest species, are very dangerous to people, and they seem to have very little fear of human beings. And so you do see a lot of predation by them in places like Ethiopia.
Can you describe some of the things you write about in the book? I mean, there are stories about hyenas who attack people and basically try to eat them alive.
Yeah, the strange thing about hyenas, this isn't really strange to them, it's strange to us, but they'll sample the food before they kill it. And so there are reports of people who are missing parts of their hands or their face or even their genitals because the hyena, you know, walking past them as they're asleep at a campfire, decides to see if that's something good to eat.
And, it's like the samples at Whole Foods.
Yeah. Jane Goodall wrote a book about hyenas in the 70s, along with Hugo von Lawick. And she was horrified. That was the exact word she used, horrified, because the hyenas that she was witnessing would run down a prey animal, a hoofed animal of some sort, and as they head it down, they would begin to eat it. And they didn't, if it was not a very formidable animal, you know, a small antelope or something, they wouldn't bother to kill it before they ate it.
Well, and some predators, as you point out, are incredibly determined. There's this amazing story you told about a leopard. You know the story about the leopard that killed one man while his friend was sitting right? Yeah, so tell that story.
Yeah, this is a famous case from the 1920s. These two men are, this was in India, and these two men were sitting in the dark. Of course, they didn't have electricity. So they were sitting there having a smoke and passing the pipe back and forth. And the sun went down, it became dark, and they were still sitting there chatting. And one friend, you know, conversation still going on, hands the pipe back to his friend, and it drops onto the carpet and the ashes spill out. So the first guy starts complaining to his friend, you know, how clumsy of you to drop it. And then he looks up and he sees the silhouette of a leopard carrying his friend out the door.
Oh my God.
So it had killed him with, you know, within a couple of feet of this man. And he didn't hear it, he didn't see anything until it was all over.
Wow. Well, that has to be the stealthiest hunter in the animal kingdom, surely.
It may well be, at least you know, on the large scale. You talk to hunters who've been to Africa, and you see the leopard mentioned over and over again as the thing that's the toughest thing to face, if it's wounded especially. They have this amazing ability to flatten themselves to the ground and to find cover in almost any kind of terrain.
I noticed that in an awful lot of the stories you tell about animal attacks, the animals tend to eat the faces off of the people that they attack. Why is that?
It depends on what animal you're talking about, but it seems like dominance issues are a big part of it. For example, a case with the grizzly bear, when it comes at you, what it wants to stop is your claim of dominance, which you're unintentionally forwarding by looking at it. So it's going to hit your face if it can. With other animals like the chimpanzee, I was sort of surprised to find out that this had been known for well over 100 years, that chimpanzees would often bite the face and the hands off of their enemies.
Really?
And I say, yeah. And when I say enemies, I mean specifically animals that they feel are threatening rather than their prey animals. When a chimpanzee fights a leopard, it'll try to bite the leopard's paws off. So anyway, the conclusion I draw from this is that when a chimpanzee attacks a human, for example, part of what it's doing is trying to remove your jaws. Because if you were a chimpanzee, your jaws would be the most dangerous part of you. So it treats you as an equal. It sees that it needs to remove your weapons.
You know, having looked at all of these stories, and your book covers many more predators than we could possibly have time to talk about, what's the sort of takeaway for you?
For me, it's always about the beauty of nature, and that may seem strange considering what I wrote about here. But it seems to me that part of that, a part of respecting other species and of preserving them even, has to include understanding what they're like and what behaviors they have and why they have those behaviors. And this was an area that I felt, this area of aggression against humans was something that I felt had been sort of, in a way, stifled. Scientists have always known about it, but what gets through to the general public in, you know, wildlife documentaries and so forth tends to have sort of a cuddly environmental message. I like the environmental message, but I like to be truthful about it and for us to understand them in their own terms.
Gordon Grice is the author of Deadly Kingdom. Anne Strangechamp spoke with him. To find out more about the books and music you've heard in this hour, stop by our website. It's ttbook.org. You can become a Facebook fan of To the Best of Our Knowledge there, too. Just follow the link. Coming up, ecologist David Abram shares the day in Alaska that changed him forever. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. David Abram is an ecologist, anthropologist, and philosopher who lectures around the world. His book, Becoming Animal, is a call to recognize the connection between our bodies and the earth we live on. He recently stopped by the studios of Wisconsin Public Radio and shared one of his most precious stories with us about the day in Alaska he rented a kayak and set off to explore the waterways in the southern part of the state.
It really was as if the sky was a bell and the hanging sun was its clapper. And it was so deliciously silent, except for the clish, closh, clish, closh, clish, closh of the paddle blades breaking the water surface. And every now and then, a water bird, a couple ducks, a cormorant, flying just above the surface, out of the distance. And then into the distance again. And then just that cloosh, clish, closh of the paddle blades. And I'm paddling toward a couple islands about 2 miles out, and way off beyond those are the snow-capped peaks of Admiralty Island, one of the barrier islands off the southern panhandle of Alaska. And as I came out the backside, the western side of these islands, I began to hear this fairly dark, cacophonous sound from my left down to the south. And I couldn't identify it. It sounded vaguely organic. So I turned the kayak toward the south and paddled down the back of the southernmost of these two islands. And I saw across the next bay that I was coming into the vicinity of one of the very large sea lion colonies found in that part of the continent. I counted over 100 of these folks all lollygagging on the rocks on the far side of the cove, soaking up the sun. And quite a large bull on my side of those rocks got up on his front flippers and with his whole torso leaning forward started bellowing at me. Arr! Arr! And then two or three other bulls up on their flippers. Arr! Arr! And then all of these sea lions seemed to be leaning up and hollering bloody murder. Arr! 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 And so I put the paddle down and spontaneously found myself doing something that, well, it's kind of a secret I had learned when I'd been skiing, backcountry skiing in western Wyoming, and had come out of a clutch of trees and found myself staring into the eyes of a mother moose. And she was very alert, her front hooves stamped in the snow, and she was just a few feet from me, and her eyes were locked on mine, and I saw one ear swivel back to listen in to the young moose, her child, behind her. And at that moment, I found myself offering this very calm, single, mellifluous note. Ah. And instantly, I saw this mother moose just relax. And I glided on past on my skis and realized that so much information is carried in the sounds we make or in a simple tone. If we are relaxed, it comes clearly across to the ears of another animal that this guy is not ready to jump me. I mean, he's not all poised to attack. So here I was in a kayak facing this gang of hollering sea lions, but if I had made as tuneful a note as ha, they would never have heard me. So I was sitting there in the kayak and I started singing, but in as guttural a voice as I could. It sounded something like this. Arr, 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 but really as loud as I could muster. And instantly all these sea lions fell silent and they started looking at one another and sniffing the air toward me and peering at one another. And there I was, this ugly duck sealed into my kayak, singing at them. Arr, arr. And once I realized that they had all quieted down and all I could hear from them was their snarfling, sniffing toward me, I picked up the paddle and began paddling stupidly, I now know, closer, cutting the distance between us in half, coming to within about 20, 25 feet of their rocks, when that same bull at that point got up on his front flippers and began this loud barking, very gruff and clearly very antagonistic. Arr, 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 arr. And then two or three others began hollering at me. And then all of those sea lions are growling. Arr, 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 arr. And it's really loud and I'm up quite close. And I put down the paddle. And so I'm about to launch into my own guttural harangue when the water just between me and those sea lions starts roiling and bubbling. And then the bubbles get bigger and bubbling yet larger, and then without any other warning, humpback whale bursts through the surface. This huge, gargantuan body flying up through the surface, its pectoral fins dangling, and then it slams down into the water, and this wave of water washes over the front of the kayak and carries my paddle off with it to the right, and I just reach back behind me and grab the end of it. Luckily, and pull it back. As I'm gazing now, this huge, gray, mottled shape floating now in front of me, sliding down beneath the surface, slipping further down, and then it's gone. And so I took up the paddle and I began back paddling very fast until I realized, you know, what am I doing, David? I have no idea where this being is going to surface again. I mean, is it going to try and upend me? I don't know. So I put the paddle down. I'm just waiting in the kayak to see what might happen. And sure enough, just off to my left, not a minute later, I start hearing this little pip, pip, pip of little bubbles breaking that become larger poppings. And then the water is boiling again. And then the boiling is overboiling. And then again, that giant body bursts through the surface, but this time entirely parallel to my kayak, and slams down, and the wall of water from this whale's slamming down now sideswipes the kayak, so I'm leaning hard to the left so as not to flip over, and then the whale spouts, and the breeze blows the spray straight into my face. I'm already drenched, but now my face is hit by the spray. And then, whew, the fetid stench of its breath. Sewage-like, I thought at first. But then, you know, what a blessing to be inhaling the breath of a humpback whale as I'm gazing the pleated folds of its throat just to my left as it's now slipping down this odd upside-down smile, and then this eye, oddly small for such an immense body, gazing me, gazing back at it, gazing back at me, as it's sliding now beneath the surface, and it's gone. And I didn't see it again. But I was left shaking in the kayak uncontrollably, a kind of slow shake, and I'm trying to calm myself down, because it's as if the great god of the deep had surfaced just between me and those sea lions, as if to say, not too close, mortal, to my kinsmen here. So I'm trying to calm down my body and take a few deep breaths when I hear this splash from the rocks, and I look over and see with some alarm that these sea lions have gotten so agitated from this visitation by their god that they're now all waddling down to the edge of the rocks and diving into the water, sort of wave after wave of sea lions now diving into the water and then surfacing with their torsos entirely out of the water, charging straight at me. Arr, 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 barking loudly, and they're coming on fast. And this is their medium. I'm an alien here. They can move with incredible grace and speed in this medium, and there's no way I could have gotten out of their way in time. And so I don't know how my own animal body came up with this, but I found myself suddenly dancing in the kayak. I mean, my arms, both of them, flew up over my head, and I started waving them from one side to the other, left to right, to left to right, my extended arms. And as soon as I did so, all of these sea lions reared back, and they started following my hands with their heads, one side to the other side, all the sea lions in unison. Wow. And they're not barking. They're not bellowing at me. So I kept my arms up there and then at one point just brought them down to grab the paddle. But as soon as I lowered my hands, all these sea lions started surging forward again. Arr, 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 arr. So my hands flew up and started rocking back and forth over my head. And instantly all those sea lions began themselves swaying back and forth. Very cool, except as I pondered the situation, I saw that any time I even began to just lower my hands, the sea lions surged forward. So I was keeping them up over my head, rocking back and forth in the kayak, and I'm thinking, wow, interesting, interesting situation, Abram. How the hell am I going to get out of this? And my shoulders are beginning to get really tired. My arms are aching. After a long stretch, I just realize I cannot keep doing this. My right arm is giving out. And so I slowly brought my right arm down while keeping my left arm overhead, swinging back and forth. And the sea lions, I saw, kept their focus on that swinging hand overhead. So I saw my chance, and I felt with my fingers and just grabbed the paddle with my right hand and sort of turned it over, and then without looking at it, just still keeping my left hand swerving from one side to the other, I started scraping the paddle with one hand against the left side of the kayak in order to paddle toward the right. And I gradually, stroke after stroke, I managed to aim the kayak around the right side of this huge gang of sea lions. And once I got off to their flank, their right flank, I brought down my other hand to the paddle and started paddling steadily out. And I didn't dare turn around for a long time. After 10 minutes, I finally snuck a look behind me. And now there were just about 20 of those sea lions following me, but at a nice, respectable distance, with just their noses out of the water. And so I kept paddling around that island and ultimately back toward the place where I'd gotten that kayak. But that experience kept me in a trance for days and days.
David Abram is the author of Becoming Animal. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. If you want to hear this program again, check an author's name, or find out about a piece of music we used, visit our website. It's ttbook.org. To buy a copy of the program, call the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for program number 1024B, Red Tooth, Red Claw. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was produced by Veronica Rickert, with help from Mary Lou Finnegan, Anne Strainchamps, Doug Gordon, and Charles Monroe Kane. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen. You can stream To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website at ttbook.org, where you will also find a link to the weekly podcast.
PRI, Public Radio International.